Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two segments up for tonight. First, in a few minutes, 5 or 6 minutes or so, we'll be speaking with Sue Sturgis of the Institute for Southern Studies on the myth of clean coal, a myth that has been given new life recently by, first of all, an article in New York Times Magazine a couple of weeks ago, and then by the Obama campaign, which is actually touting the virtues of clean coal as well. Perhaps not coincidentally, Illinois is a coal-producing state. Of course, no one wants to lose the electoral votes of West Virginia. In any case, the truth demands some straight talk about the dirtiness of coal and the impossibility of making it clean. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Adolf Reed, who is a professor of political science at University of Pennsylvania and author of a piece in the Black Agenda Report, which everyone should be reading the Black Agenda Report all the time, but blackagendareport.com. But he's got a big piece, the featured piece in the Black Agenda Report this week, where Obamaism seems to be going. The poll quote is, it's ironic that Obama could be the one to complete Clintonism's redefinition of liberalism as conservatism. So we'll talk to Adolf Reed about that provocative formulation. And before all that, some words about the economic news. The big story of the week was, of course, the concerted effort to shore up confidence in what are usually described as those mortgage giants, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. It wasn't a bailout exactly, just a pledge to bail them out if necessary. It's absolutely certain that the U.S. government will not let them go down or even give the appearance of their going down. Fannie Mae, short for the Federal National Mortgage Association, was founded in 1938, late in the New Deal years, to provide support for a suffering housing market in the Great Depression. Its aim was to inject funds into a torpid mortgage market by buying them up from lenders. The lenders, with fresh cash in their books, could then make new loans with that fresh cash. To fund its buying, Fannie Mae then packaged the mortgages that it bought into bonds, which could be then bought by institutional investors like mutual funds and pension funds. Fannie Mae was privatized in 1968 during the Johnson years to get the entity's debt off the government's books. The Vietnam War was putting immense strain on Washington's finances, so nothing like a privatization of part of its debt to make things look better. 2 years later came the founding of Freddie Mac, the Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corp, which essentially duplicated Fannie Mae's role but was supposed to provide some competition. It was private from the first. Both have been wildly successful at directing funds into the mortgage market. Since 2000, total mortgage debt outstanding in the U.S. more than doubled, from just over $4 trillion to just over $10 trillion. These are very large numbers, even by the standards of the U.S. economy. And Fannie and Freddie, also known as government-sponsored enterprises, or GSEs, greased along about half that growth. It all helped fuel the craziest bubble in the history of American house prices, a history that goes back more than a century. Of course, that's all history now. Now we're dealing with the aftermath: bankruptcy, foreclosure, write-offs, financial crisis. Fannie and Freddie did all this mortgage buying on a very thin base of capital. They're allowed to do this because supporting the housing market is practically our national religion, and because the two entities were masters at currying political favor. They hired lobbyists and seduced everyone in the business into going to bat for them. Since they have so little capital of their own, the only way they can keep paying interest and principal on their outstanding bonds is if homeowners keep paying interest and principal on their outstanding mortgages. Fannie and Freddie don't hold any subprime mortgages, nor do they hold any of the so-called jumbo stuff, mortgages that is higher than the mid-six figures. They hold the broad middle of the American housing market, or its mortgages. That's turning a little sour, but not critically so, at least not yet. J.P. Morgan Chase Chair Jamie Dimon said the other day that it looks like about 3% of prime mortgages may go bad. That would translate into about $150 billion in losses at Fannie and Freddie. That would have to be covered somehow, meaning, in all likelihood, by the U.S. Treasury, meaning you and me, including the 40% of us, including me, who unpatriotically rent rather than own our dwellings. And so the government, in the person of Treasury Secretary Henry Hank Paulson, stepped in to offer reassurance. The details of what he said aren't important right now. What matters is that he made it clear that the Gov would do anything to keep Fannie and Freddie's nostrils above water. He has no choice in this. Though these are private enterprises, they were understood by everyone in the financial markets as having an implicit government guarantee. Because that guarantee was only implicit, the interest rate offered on their bonds was slightly above that for actual U.S. Treasury obligations. But investors bought them as if they were treasuries and took that interest premium as icing on the cake. Among those investors who bought Fannie and Freddie Mac in great quantities are foreign central banks, notably China's. All these together hold something like $1 trillion worth of these securities. If there were any kind of hint that these were at the risk of default, it would be the equivalent of a default by the U.S. government, not in the legal sense, but in the psychological sense. And if that happened, if the U.S. government were seen as defaulting, the world would probably come to an end. Well, not quite, but something like it. This bailout, like all the others, is essential to keep the financial system from imploding. But to Paulson and the rest of the ruling orthodoxy, the bailouts are mostly a blank check, an attempt to restore the status quo before the crisis began. That strikes me as a very bad deal. As I've also said every time I've mentioned the inevitability of a government bailout, we should get something in return, like stricter disclosure and much tighter regulation. On the Freddie Fannie issue, Dean Baker of the Center for Economic and Policy Research has suggested that they be prohibited in the future from buying mortgages on houses whose prices are way out of line with local rents. Another standard, which Dean didn't suggest, could be the ratio of house prices to local incomes. You just want some measure of reasonable value. During the recent bubble, house prices got way above rents and incomes, a sign that things were really spinning out of control. Putting some value-based limit on prices would be a good way to prevent a recurrence of the bubble. And while we're at it, why not a rethink of the whole national obsession with homeownership? Why do people get themselves in way over their heads just to own their house? Financial gains are mostly illusory, especially if you add up all the interest paid on a mortgage. Why should the tax code subsidize buyers who are generally better off than renters? And why should we as a nation, with a crumbling infrastructure, a declining industrial base, and the profound challenge of climate change facing us, put so much capital into bigger and bigger houses set in ever sprawlier suburbs? Bailing out Fannie and Freddie is essential, but wouldn't it be nice to rein them in after this is all over? I know that that's unthinkable under present circumstances, but that's why I'm here, to think the unthinkable. Last week, I said the oil market was looking like a bubble, and while the oil market is tight, prices around $140 a barrel just weren't justified. There was nothing I could see in the fundamentals that it could explain why oil prices doubled over the last year, increased tenfold over the last decade. So, I argued, it was almost certain that speculators were driving prices far above what the real physical world would set. My conclusion was that I wouldn't be at all surprised to see the oil bubble burst, just like the housing and pets.com bubbles did in years past. Wow, it's not often I get to take a victory lap over a prediction, especially just a week after the fact. But it's as if the markets had heard me. Oil prices fell by more than $15, that is 10%, between Tuesday and Thursday. I'd be surprised if they continued straight down, especially at that speed, but there's a good chance that the turnabout has begun. There's nothing like a recession in the world's biggest energy hog, the U.S., to put a damper on demand. If the downtrend continues, then the Federal Reserve can stop worrying about inflation and turn its full attention to getting us out of the financial mess that its previous chair, Alan Greenspan, played no small part in creating. And it's not every day you get a letter, and a real letter, you know, the ink on paper kind, not an email, from a listener that begins, "I am an atonal composer." But I got one of those recently, a fan of this show named Julie Harting, who is a neighbor of mine in the Upper West Side. And she is a composer of music in the atonal style. She was inspired to write by hearing Arnold Schoenberg on the show. And I asked her to send along some of her music if she could, and she did. Let's listen to a bit of a solo clarinet piece by Julie Harting called Coagula. And this is played by Enid Blunt Press on the clarinet, an instrument that I played long ago in a previous life. All right, a bit of Coagula. Thank you. And that a bit of the piece Coagula for solo clarinet, composed by Julie Harting, a listener to this show. And that was played by Enid Blunt Press. And we'll hear a little bit more of Coagula at the half-hour mark. And you can hear more of Julie Harting's music on her website, which is at Julie Harting, Harting, HARTING.com, JulieHarting.com. And now we're joined on the line by Sue Sturgis, who is an editor with the Institute for Southern Studies and blogs frequently on their Facing South website. Welcome to Behind the News,
Thank
Sue Sturgis.
You so much, Doug.
So we've heard a lot about clean coal lately. There was a real enthusiastic, you might say, puff piece about it in the New York Times Magazine a few weeks ago. And I think the Obama campaign is actually promoting clean coal as part of the energy package. Not coincidentally, Illinois, a coal-producing state, but you know, he's not alone in this enthusiasm. Is there really such a thing as clean coal?
No, it's actually an oxymoron. coal perhaps could be cleaner, but it will never be clean, because when we think about coal, it's really important for us to think about the whole process involved in producing energy from coal. And that includes mining, burning, and disposing of the coal combustion waste that's left after burning. And all of those are very dirty.
Well, let's go through the sequence. Let's start with the mining. And the piece in the Times Magazine to which you responded on the Facing South website is specifically about Duke Power, a major coal user. Tell us where Duke gets its coal.
Well, Duke gets a lot of the coal that it burns at its plants here in North Carolina, where I live, from mountaintop removal mining. And this is a form of mining that evolved in the 1970s out of strip mining. And what they're actually doing is they're using explosives to blow off the tops of mountains throughout central and southern Appalachia to get at the coal seams beneath. And the waste that's produced from the explosions is being dumped into the river valleys below, and it's causing a lot of environmental problems there. And as I mentioned, Duke is a major user of mountaintop removal coal, but I should mention that WBAI itself has a connection to mountaintop removal coal.
Uh-oh, what's that?
there's a terrific website that your readers might be interested in at ilovemountains.org. And what you could do is you could go to this website and put in your zip code, and it tells you who your power provider is and where your coal is coming from. So I thought it would be interesting to look and see where WBAI is getting its coal from. And Con Edison is actually getting a lot of its coal from a place called Buffalo Creek, West Virginia.
So, same process.
Same process. And actually, Buffalo Creek, back in 1972, 125 people were killed there when a dam built out of the coal mine waste broke, and it released hundreds of thousands of gallons of wastewater that's left over after the coal is washed in the process. And people were killed. And even today, the people of Buffalo Creek and people in other communities throughout West Virginia, Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee are still living with these sludge ponds and the constant fear that there could be another dam burst like this. And so, you know, when we hear about clean coal, we often hear people talking about a very narrow step in the entire process, which is, you know, there might be some way for us to capture the carbon dioxide as the coal is burned. And, you know, that there certainly are efforts underway to develop that technology. But even if we were to do that and perfect that, nothing that Con Ed did to capture the carbon during the coal burning would solve the problem of what's happening down in West Virginia.
Is there any more ecologically sensitive way to get at the coal than blowing up mountains and dumping the waste in rivers?
Well, you know, there's people who live in these communities who aren't necessarily opposed to mining because their livelihoods actually depend on it. And so there, you know, there are people who are pushing for ways to mine that don't involve blowing off mountaintops. But I don't think that there's any way to mine coal that could be called in any objective way clean. It's just it's a dirty process.
And of course, the miners themselves are subject to horrendous risks, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, could you describe some of those?
Well, I could talk a little bit from personal experience because I actually grew up in a coal mining community myself. I'm from eastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal mining region, And one of my grandfathers was a coal miner, and the other grandfather worked in a colliery where they processed the coal, and both of them suffered from black lung. This is a disease where the coal dust that you're exposed to, whether in the mine or the colliery, gets into your lungs and eventually at some point makes breathing nigh impossible. And so particularly my paternal grandfather, who was the miner, had very severe black lung, and it eventually killed him. And when you watch somebody die of black lung, you're watching someone suffocate to death, and it's a very slow, difficult, painful death. And also in my family, I've had relatives who were killed by rock falls in the mines, which is one of the perils. You know, we had heard about cases out west where people were doing something that's called robbing the pillars, where you go in and you actually take the coal out of the pillars that are left to hold up the roof. It's a way to get at the mines and to maximize the money you're making out of them. And it's very dangerous, and it puts miners at risk. And as we've seen, it's led to collapses of coal mines. So, you know, that's just another way that coal is actually very dirty and hazardous.
I was speaking with Sue Sturgis of the Institute for Southern Studies, who blogs on the Facing South website, which is at southernstudies.org. You can check out what she and her colleagues do. Excellent work, Institute for Southern Studies. Also publish Southern Exposure magazine, another fine product from that house. In the New York Times article, the chair of Duke Energy says, I tell people that Duke is really just a company that processes chemicals to produce clean air, and we get electricity as a byproduct. That's quite a slick phrase. Is there any truth to that?
To say that Duke is producing clean air, I think, is quite a stretch. And anybody who would like to find out exactly what's coming out of coal plants could go to the Environmental Protection Agency's website at epa.gov. And they have a function on there called the TRI Explorer, and that's the Toxics Release Inventory. And Duke Energy and all of the other coal burners in the country are obligated to report to the government what exactly is coming out of their smokestacks. And Duke is emitting to the air millions and millions of pounds of various pollutants every year. These include what are known as criteria pollutants like sulfur dioxide that contribute to global warming, and also hazardous pollutants like arsenic and lead and mercury. And certainly whatever process they are doing to help clean up the emissions from their smokestacks are not eliminating these hazardous emissions altogether. And the other issue that it's really important for folks to keep in mind is that, you know, we really have made a lot of gains in recent years in terms of the kinds of technologies we have available to put on the smokestacks. There are different scrubbers available that can capture pollution before it's released into the air, but this in turn creates a whole other problem. That waste has to go somewhere, and it's actually a really sizable waste stream, which I think a lot of people aren't necessarily aware of.
Yeah, the Times article says it just produces gypsum, which goes into wallboard.
It does produce a substance that's used to create synthetic gypsum, and this is used in construction products like wallboard. But it, you know, it produces also all of the impurities that are in coal. And as I mentioned, this includes things like arsenic, lead, mercury, also radionuclides, because coal typically is slightly radioactive. All of that stuff is also collected, and this has to go somewhere. And right now, the federal government does not regulate coal combustion waste. And that has led to a lot of problems throughout the coal fields. And actually,
where was the stuff dumped?
It's typically dumped in lagoons that are right next to the coal-fired power plants. And this has caused all sorts of problems. Each year in the United States, we're producing about 129 million tons of coal combustion waste, just so people can get a handle on the size of the problem that we're talking about. And so all of this stuff has to go somewhere. Only a very small portion of it is used in any sort of any kind of beneficial use, like wallboard. Most of it is just being dumped into either unlined landfills, lagoons, or in Pennsylvania, they're using it to they're filling abandoned mines with the material.
Well, this must seep into groundwater and such, doesn't it?
It does, exactly. The point that I was going to make is the coal combustion waste has contaminated drinking water supplies in at least 8 states now. And Duke Energy is actually linked to an incident in North Carolina where an entire ecosystem near one of its coal combustion waste lagoons was contaminated with really high levels of selenium. and it wiped out all of the fish that were living in that lake but for one species. And so it really has quite a devastating effect. And there's currently a push underway to get the federal government to regulate coal combustion waste, but at this point they're not doing it. And the state regulations at this moment in time are really just a patchwork, and they haven't proven adequate to protect us from these sorts of contamination incidents.
And is there any way to do this in an environmentally sensitive manner, or is just this stuff just really too hot to handle?
Well, it's going to create a problem no matter what. There's a group out there called the Clean Air Task Force that has done a lot of work around the coal combustion waste issue over the years. And, they're not calling for an end to burning coal or to dumping coal combustion waste, but they'd like to see it disposed of in a more environmentally safe manner. And that would mean a lined landfill, something that, you know, it isn't open to the groundwater, something that would have to be monitored, something that's done in a much more careful way than just, you know, dump it and, you know, let's hope that it doesn't contaminate any water. And so there is a push underway now to get the federal government to regulate this.
Coal is a very important source of our electricity. We really couldn't stop burning it just anytime soon, could we?
It's going to take a process to transition us. I mean, clearly this is an enormous source still of electricity in this country, and we certainly couldn't tomorrow declare that all of the coal-burning power plants are going to shut down. Right now, the folks who are fighting the opening of new power plants, though, are trying to make the point that at this particular moment in time, when we're facing a climate crisis, we've been warned by climate experts, people like Jim Hansen, who is a professor there in New York at Columbia University and heads up NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, earlier this year warned us that we really don't want to surpass 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere if we want to avoid abrupt and potentially quite devastating changes in our climate. But we're already higher than that. We're already at about 380 parts per million. And so the question is now, do we want to concentrate our resources on building new coal plants, coming up with new technologies for coal plants, or do we want to actually switch to renewable sources of energy? And that's the decision that we're faced with right now as a country. And I thought it was interesting that today Al Gore actually made a quite historic speech where he's calling for us to take our money and put it in renewables rather than in coal.
Now, a lot of people who have fantasies about clean coal also think about transforming it, you know, not just burning it, it's the state at which it comes out of the ground, but transforming it into other end chemical ways that would produce some kind of cleaner fuel. Is that also a fantasy?
Well, I've heard this discussion about using coal to produce fuels, but again, I think we have to question the notion that this is somehow clean. One thing I think we should mention right away is, you know, this phrase clean coal. And whenever I say it, I'm saying it with quotation marks around it because I really don't buy the idea that it's clean. But one of the reasons why we hear that phrase so much nowadays is there's a $40 million marketing campaign underway. And this is being run by an industry group called the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. They were formerly called Americans for Balanced Energy Choices.
Let me guess, that's sponsored by the coal industry.
The coal industry and the electrical utility industry. These are the mining interests and the coal-burning interests who are promoting this marketing campaign right now. And that's actually the group you might recall that sponsored the CNN Democratic presidential debate back in January, where the candidates were asked no questions about the climate crisis. And they're also running TV commercials right now touting so-called clean coal. And so, you know, just so your listeners understand, that's one of the reasons why they're hearing so much about this clean coal right now. But the Bush administration has also really seized on this idea of clean coal, and they actually have an initiative underway right now to promote technologies that they're designating as clean coal. And you had mentioned the idea of turning coal into some sort of fuel that we could run our vehicles on. And next door to you all in Pennsylvania, there is actually one of these projects is underway with federal funding, and they are building a plant that would take waste coal, and this is the coal that's already been deemed too impure to burn in a regular power plant. And they want to take this and through a special process, turn it into synthetic diesel fuel. And so this is actually getting money through this Clean Coal Initiative. And so then you ask yourself, well, just how clean is this particular project? And so I went and I looked to see what their permit was. They had to get a permit from the state to pollute the air. And so what are they expecting to release to the air? Well, 99.9 tons each year of sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, carbon monoxide, particulate pollution, 49.9 tons of volatile organic compounds, and 38 pounds of mercury. At the same time, the Department of Energy estimates that the plant would release 2.3 million tons of carbon dioxide each year. And now keep in mind that this is one of the projects that's getting subsidies from us, the taxpayer, as a clean coal project. I think there's really serious questions about how clean is this.
And another claim we hear about coal is that it's cheap. We certainly have a lot of it in this country, hundreds of years' worth at current levels of consumption, but it's also a lot cheaper, or so it seems, than the equivalent amount of oil. How cheap is coal, really?
Well, you know, it's a hard question to answer, because the way that we price coal right now, we externalize a lot of the costs that are associated with coal. So, for instance, you know, we say coal is cheap, but yet we're not requiring the people who mine it or burn it to put any limits on carbon dioxide. So, you know, the people are then bearing the expenses that result from the sort of climate disruption that we're causing by burning the coal. We also, here in North Carolina, for instance, if you go to western North Carolina, the Smoky Mountains, nowadays are living up to their name. And one of the reasons is that we have a lot of pollution drifting into the mountains of western North Carolina from the Tennessee Valley Authority coal plants in Tennessee. And actually, right now, there's a trial underway where the Attorney General of North Carolina has sued TVA to try to get them to put some sort of controls on their plants to keep that from happening. But, you know, there's a terrible problem in the mountains now with asthma and other respiratory disorders that are related to this pollution, and that's another externalized cost that the coal industry, the electrical utility industry, doesn't bear. They're externalizing that. That goes to us to pay. So, you know, it becomes a tricky question, and I'm certainly not an economist, to say, you know, what would coal really cost if we were to take all of these externalized costs and stop externalizing them? I think we'd find out that it's actually a very expensive form of energy.
Well, I think you could say the same about all our forms of energy right now, but we don't like to internalize costs under the present system.
Yeah.
I've been speaking with Sue Sturgis, who is the editorial director of the Institute for Southern Studies, a regular blogger, on the Facing South website, and you can check out all that work at southernstudies.org on the web. Okay, thank you for joining us, Sue Sturgis. Let's take a break, and we'll be back with Adolf Reed.
What's the other thing that scares you?
Hi, this is Jamie.
Hi, this is Sarah from Brand Van 3000, and you're listening to
WBAI 99.5 FM.
New York.
And this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on your FM dial, and also WBAI.org on the web. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. And let's listen to some more of Julie Harting's piece for solo clarinet, Coagula, performed by Enid Blunt Press.
Auch deine Wunde. Rosa. Thank you.
And that's more of the piece Coagula for Solo Clarinet, performed by Julie Harting, performed by Enid Blunt Press, written by Julie Harting, a listener to this show. And she sent along a CD with a couple of her pieces, and I'm very pleased because they're really very, very fine. And you can check out her some more of her music on the web at Julie Harting, H-A-R-T-I-N-G, Julie, J-U-L-I-E, .com. And you heard a bit of a poem, which is also read during the piece in German and then in English by Paul Celan, Coagula, Auch deine Wunde, Rosa, your wound too, Rosa, Rosa being Rosa Luxemburg. So a little bit of politics meant the atonal music. We're now joined by Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and author of a piece featured on the Black Commentator website this week, Where Obamaism Seems to Be Going. Welcome, Adolf. Oh,
hi, Doug. How you doing?
Very good. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. Although I just caught the tail end of the music, and I loved the clarinet, so I'm going to check that out. But one small correction: it's the Black Agenda Report, not the Black Commentator.
Oh, didn't I say Black Agenda Report? I'm so sorry. BlackAgendaReport.com. BlackAgendaReport.com. Yeah, the Black Commentator is somewhat in the Obama camp.
I believe,
but not you.
No, not quite.
the pull quote they feature in the piece, which is certainly a provocative sentence, is that it's ironic that Obama, having defeated Hillary Clinton, would be the one to complete Clintonism's redefinition of liberalism as conservatism. As they say in academia, could you unpack that for us?
Sure. Well, I mean, you can just look at the moves that Obama's made since he became the presumptive nominee, which, of course, aren't any different from moves that he'd made before he was the presumptive nominee. It's just that people pretended not to see them or hear them, or the Kool-Aid inebriation was so thick that they couldn't. The AIPAC speech, for instance, where he's aligned himself, or he aligned himself with the farthest right Zionist parties in Israel. His promise, as it were, to expand the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and this was on the Times a few days ago, even more generically, any place in what he calls Mesopotamia. This is something that Tom Hayden seemed not to notice until a couple of days ago, since he's got an alternate piece now that I saw today expressing his concerns about this. Frankly, Obama had told us all that more than a year ago, because and I wrote about it in my November 2007 progressive column. But his approach to social policy, his victim blaming discourse about poverty, we can keep going, I guess. The way that he's gone out of his way three times in one session to align himself with the Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, Alito faction of the Supreme Court. And what I think is most insidious about this is it is that Obama has succeeded, I think, for reasons that partly have to do with his race. The naivete of youth and other such considerations has, and I should add, a kind of ham-fisted, or not even ham-fisted, a kind of dilettantish understanding of what community organizing is and what movements are and what politics is, has been able to represent himself as the embodiment of progressivism, so that what he does, by definition, must be the boundary of progressive politics. And as you can recall, and most of your adult listeners can recall, this is a move that Clinton, the same kind of move that Clinton made, Bill Clinton, that is, but not quite as successfully as Obama, since he he didn't have the same kind of street cred, as it were, for being a real progressive activist of some sort.
But he was our nation's first black president.
I think that really belongs to Warren Harding.
Oh, right, yes.
But he's the first one since Warren Harding, anyway.
I think John McLaughlin is on that hobby horse, too.
Yeah, that puts me in good company.
So let's take some of these issues a turn, and I think we haven't talked in a couple of months on this show, but certainly some of the bloom is off the Obama rose, but there's right. still some bloom remaining. So let's see what we can do to dislodge it.
Okay,
he's Glenn Greenwald, the liberal blogger, was praising Obama's bold step of dumping on poor black people. What do you make of all that?
Well, I was kind of surprised. I guess in one way I was, in one way I wasn't. I mean, Greenwald, I've seen some of his stuff on Salon.com. I'm not an avid blog follower, but some of it seemed pretty good. But from within the context of that kind of liberal goo-goo politics, I mean, I think it's instructive that those of the Obamistas in the blog world seemed most exercised by his FISA vote. And, I mean, don't get me wrong, the FISA vote was pretty repugnant. But I don't think it was any more repugnant than the death penalty stance or the abortion stance or what was the third one at the Supreme Court? Oh, yeah, the gun control stance. And certainly no less repugnant than his penchant for dumping on black poor people through this. I mean, he's like this is interestingly another way that he's the follow-up to Bill Clinton. I mean, this, as you know, is something that Clinton was quite adept at. He goes speak to the black audience and get props for being there. You get the photo op for black Democrats for being there and being able to connect with the black audience at the church or wherever else. But you also get props from the conservative base or the punditry or wherever you get these props for hectoring the black audiences with the underclass discourse. And
But these things are often met with wild applause.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, that's also a good question. I think one reason is that it's the coin of the realm, right? So that's a hegemonic consensus about why people are poor now. I mean, that's one of the ways that the right has been victorious. And again, it's a way, like so many ways, that the right's been victorious, that their victory has been possible only because, you know, only to the extent that it's been abetted by liberals. I mean, I will lay a lot of this, frankly, at the feet of William Julius Wilson and the poverty research industry, who have, for more than 25 years, been operating, have been sustaining and reproducing a discourse about poverty, its sources, and therefore its remedies that focus almost entirely on the putative behavior of poor people. One of the tragic expressions of this hegemonic discourse, it's really poignant, is often when you talk to people who are in what remains of public of low-income public housing projects or on whatever remains of public assistance, what you'd get, and it's been like this for a long time, is people would say in casual conversation, you know, I'm not like a lot of these people in the projects or on welfare. I'm trying to do something for myself. I'm trying to go to school, better myself, get a job. You know, a lot of these people just kind of sit around and all they do is wait for the welfare check to come. So there's the general, so there's the permeation of the hegemonic discourse, right, such that this is the language that's available even for people who are poor to define their own condition. Now, I would inject, however, that when poor people are given the opportunity to express themselves on whether they need role modeling at the office of their moral and class betters, they tend to get really pissed off by it. I hope I can say that on the air. But they react, they tend, studies that I've seen react very negatively to this notion that they need to be taught how to act or taught proper behavior. But it is, the coin of the realm. It's also the case that there's a powerful conservative strain that runs through a lot of these black churches, and for good reason. I mean, not only is the religion itself fundamentally conservative, despite what people like to say, but victim blaming, after all, sin lives within you, but there's also a material foundation for this in that the retreat of the public sector has made, and this is Obama's other big move of the last few weeks, has whetted the appetites of the Christers for being able to get their hands on federal social service budgets. And it makes all the more sense that they'll be able to get more and more of the federal social service money to the extent that they argue that fighting poverty requires, in addition to a bag of groceries every now and then, moral uplift and rearmament.
Well, what do you make of the fact that so many liberals who were alarmed and outraged when George Bush proposed channeling public funds into churches to do social programs, when Obama proposes this, we suddenly find excuses being made?
Well, Doug, I mean, as you know, I'm not a the sort of person to throw charges of racism around wildly or in the willy-nilly way. But I think there's something like that, right? I mean, there's this sense that, you know, blacks are a Jesus-loving people, as it were, right? And, you know, I mean, this is a notion that's been reinforced through the reinvention of the civil rights movement as a product of churches and all this stuff that largely emanates from middle-class, moral, socially conservative academics, ultimately, you know, about how the church is the font and the wellspring of black identity and solace under slavery and Jim Crow and everything else. And I think there is a very disturbing, I'd say certainly exasperating tendency among far too many white liberals to, and even leftists, to imagine that black people are fundamentally different and opaque or from themselves and culturally or attitudinally or dispositionally opaque to them in some ways. So whenever some black person pops up and says, well, you know, blacks are from Venus, whites are from Mars, you know, blacks say potato, whites say potato, they're just all too willing to accept it and go on.
Especially if Jesus is involved.
Especially if Jesus is involved.
Speaker with Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Where Obamaism Seems to Be Going, which is the featured piece on the Black Agenda Report website. That's a Black Agenda Report, all one word, .com, which everyone should be reading attentively. A very fine, do we call it a publication?
I don't know. I never know what to call things online. I don't know whether I should put published in quotation marks or what. I guess this is one thing 20-year-olds are good for.
Yeah, well, we can, do you have a Facebook page?
Who, me?
Yeah.
God, no. You?
I do, I have to admit, yes.
Yeah, well, it's part of your job, right?
Yeah, well, self-promotion is never... well, it seems, you write about this in the article, but I'm going to put it in my own way, that attention seems mostly paid to the people who occupy the slots of poverty and deprivation in this society, much more than the economy's propensity to produce those slots of deprivation and poverty. Is that how does the Obama campaign fit into that?
Well, I think that's an eloquent way to put it. And I've heard people crying foul and complaining that he's. I just saw a comment posted on the BAR from some your groupie, not long before you called, saying, "Well, it's not fair to say this because he's proposed tripling the EITC, you know, the earned income tax credit, and this, that, and the other." But the point is, and this is one of the characteristics of his Philadelphia speech, what I was calling at the time the Compromise of 2008, or the Philadelphia Compromise speech, evoking Booker T. Washington, that people were so excited about, that yes, he made passing references to the history the historically embedded logics of inequity and discrimination that were built into various New Deal programs and federal housing policy in the past, insofar as he has ever discussed remedies or proximate sources of poverty, it's been to focus on people's behavior. I just saw a couple of days ago that he made some, this may have been also in the Chicago Father's Day speech, I'm not sure, it's hard to keep up with these things now, but made some comment about how one community development strategy would be to stop throwing garbage out the window. I mean, so, and this is exactly the kind of thing that Booker T. Washington did in the Atlanta Compromise speech of 1895, where he told racist, self-deprecating stories about chicken stealing to connect, I suppose, with his white elite audience. Obama, in his talk with the evangelicals, said that, well, the problems of poverty are too big for government to solve. News to me. I thought, I thought, frankly, that's the reason that we had government, say, from 1933 until 1980 or so.
Well, it's done a pretty good job in other countries of, if
yes,
not eliminating, reducing it very deeply.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, so to that extent, I mean, Obama has shown no inclination to support support what used to be called social wage policies. Now, I know the supporters will say, well, my God, you can't expect that of him in this ideological climate. And maybe even some people will say that, and I've heard this argument too, that especially as a black candidate, he's got to go the extra step. And this is certainly something I've argued about black mayors also. And he's got to go the extra step to prove that he's not a dangerous radical.
Well, I think a guy with the middle name Hussein is going to have to go the extra step to show that he's not a terrorist sympathizer.
I think that's probably right. But people don't, don't want to follow that up with the next question then. Well, then if he's got to go the extra step and be even farther to the right than some other mainstream Democratic hack would be, then what exactly is the virtue in electing him, and how exactly does this make him a transformative politician, whatever that might be?
Yeah, they love that term. Who was it? Somebody, I think David Sirota said the other day, despite all these compromises, he remains transformative.
Yes, I saw that.
Precisely the nature of that transformation is never specified.
No, it isn't. And in fact, it never has been. Well, I mean, I was struck, in the Times article a week or so ago about the far left, how Obama's far left supporters were getting skeptical. This one 23-year-old, and admittedly, he was 23 and he was in Portland, but who's a minion of this young hack Democrat training program out there, said, well, Obama is a different kind of politician. That's self-evident.
Right. Well, Thomas Jefferson used that phrase, too. So it's got
I believe he did.
It's got a long pedigree. You say in the piece, at this point, a lot of people say, forget the two parties and let's look at Nader or McKinney. And you say in the piece, third-party candidates, in reality, are just the same as not voting, only more costly and more time-consuming. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, as I said, I've had a little bit of experience with electorally based third-party activity. I was somewhat involved in the Commoner campaign in 1980, which is where I learned the lessons about the limits of this stuff, I think. And I've voted for Ralph when the alternative was to vote for Joe Lieberman and Al Gore. But one of the things we've got to do as leftists in this country, and I think I'm going to try to purge the term progressive out of my vocabulary. It's completely evacuated of meaning.
Well, like the way Alex Coburn spells it, progressive.
Yes, he does, yes. And I think, it's always struck me that there may be one particular guy up in Vermont that he's making fun of when he does that, but I'm not sure.
Maybe so.
But anyway, I think leftists need to break with this notion that you build a movement through elections, right? I mean, there's a sense,
especially presidential elections.
Especially those. Yeah, but I think even local ones. I mean, I think that, but especially presidential elections, there's no question, because the idea is it's kind of like the way Trotskyist parties approach this stuff, right? The underlying presumption is that there is an extant base out there that exists for a progressive or for a left political program, and the problem is that we haven't gotten the right message. We haven't packaged it the right way. We don't have the right candidate who can galvanize people. And frankly, this is one of, this mindset, I think, is one of the things that Obama's been able to exploit, right? If we can just get the right face, just get the right message, just get the right charismatic individual, just get the right slogan. The fact of the matter is that bases aren't called together like that, right? There's no naturally formed constituency that exists, right? You've got to create it, and you create it through organizing, through building alliances and relationships and solidarities through struggle over time, right? It's like the difference between organizing a union shop, in a shop, and running an election, right? Both depend on making house calls, for instance. In electoral house calling, the objective is to drop the literature and not engage in any, and engage in as little interaction as you possibly can with the person who's at home, if there's anybody at home, because the key is hitting as many units as you possibly can in the course of a day. In union organizing and other kinds of organizing, house calling, the idea, you want somebody to invite you in. You want somebody to offer you a cup of coffee. You want to sit and talk with them and hear what they're thinking and the building connections with them. And finding out the kind of things that people want to struggle about. I mean, that's what that sort of organizing is. And that's the kind of work that will, over time, build alliances that can help people through the course of fighting with them for things that are important to them, can help people see the world, you know, a little differently, even imagine in one of the slogans of the day that another world is possible in concrete terms, right, not just the T-shirt, broaden the horizons of what people perceive to be the horizons of the possible. And you can't do that through an election. So to that extent, I mean, what the election can do is, as I said in the article, collect what are register individual protests. But, you know, I mean, that's fine, I guess, if somebody wants to do it. I think the problem is, and this was the experience, you know, this is my experience in the Commoner campaign, it takes a lot of effort and energy and money and, you know, resources to go into sustaining something like that. And once you file as a candidate, the logic that has to drive the campaign is to get as many votes as you possibly can, punto, no matter what. And it's like a friend of mine in college used to say about acid. You know, once you buy the ticket, you've got to take the ride, right? Right? And there's no other way.
I'm afraid we're going to have to end on that aphorism because we're out of time.
Oh, okay.
And that's too good to follow up on. I've been speaking with Adolf Reed, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, author of a piece on the Black Agenda Report website, which everyone should visit frequently. About where Obamaism is going. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. I will be back next week. And let's go out with this. It's a cliche, I know, but it seems an apt one at the moment. It's a cliche, so shoot me. Till next week. Bye.